when the work that you're engaged in looks painfully, laughably unimpressive. That might be at the level of whole congregations. Perhaps numbers are dwindling. Perhaps we're all frail and sick and a little broken, and we're struggling even to maintain good relationships with each other. Perhaps that's at the level of the particular ministry you're involved with. Ones and twos serving away in the kids' work, in the youth group, in perhaps meeting for Bible study with a friend. And it seems so unimpressive and frustrating and seems to be going backwards as often as it's going forwards. Perhaps we can go the other way and think of the national church situation and all of the inter-Nicene rivalries and false teaching and stupid decisions, and the churches are emptying, and we can't even agree on why that is. And the nation looks on and laughs at us. The work we're engaged in is laughably unimpressive. I was chatting with David earlier in the week about this. Christian ministry is meant to be unimpressive, but it certainly feels that way. And one of the reasons it can feel that way, certainly for me in pulpit ministry, is that you can preach your heart out week after week and have no real idea whether anyone's even listening to what you're saying, let alone whether it is transformative in people's lives. And we are a society that is built on wanting to measure everything. We are in a scientific age, and we want to be able to quantify exactly what the fruit of everything we do is, and ministry doesn't work like that. And so churches become places full of activity, full of doing things. If we can't measure the spiritual growth of the congregation, at least we can measure the number of things in our diaries. And that will have to act as a suitable substitute. We substitute quantity for quality and measurables for the unmeasurable. And there is a great danger for us in the church being unimpressive. The danger is that we try to measure the wrong things in an effort to comfort ourselves, that we're doing the right things after all. And so the danger is we give up. We become discouraged when we look at the right things or we look at the wrong things. Both of those are mistakes that we can make, and one of those is a mistake that is being made in Haggai chapter 2. Now, for those of you who missed last week, let me fill you in on where we are. Haggai comes to the remnant of those living in the land. They've been back from exile for 20 years, and he comes to tell them that God is not satisfied with their work. They've built their own houses, but they've neglected to rebuild the temple, and he warns them the covenant with Moses is still in place, and they face God's curses. And wonderfully, the people of God have responded rightly. They have repented, and with God on their side, they've got to work building the temple. And this week, we pick the story up just a few weeks later. We're less than a month on. And for context, Ezra tells us that rebuilding the temple takes 4 years. So in baking terms, we're about 5 minutes into the bake-off. The ingredients are all over the place. Everything's a mess. The cook looks absolutely frantic, and nobody has any idea what the final cake is going to look like. But something is already clear. It won't be very impressive. Verse 3. Who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? How does it look to you now? Does it not seem to you like nothing? The point of reference here is the temple that Solomon built. We've been thinking about that from 2 Chronicles. It's full of the golden articles that the nations have brought to Solomon and have been blessed. It's tall and it's wide and it's ornately carved and it's shining white and it's got cedar paneling all through the inside, coated in gold, and it's just deeply impressive. And already, just 3 or 4 weeks into the build, it is quite clear to anyone who saw the Solomonic Temple, and anyone with just an ounce of imagination, that this one will be nothing like as impressive as the last. Even if it's years until they finish it, it's smaller and it is unimpressive. Think about where they are. There are few of them. Few people to contribute money, few people to contribute labour. Perhaps there isn't a particularly experienced foreman amongst them, nor a master stonemason. Perhaps the building materials are whatever they can scrounge and get their hands on. Old bits of rubble that have been left over from the destruction of the temple the first time. They can't particularly afford to import from the best suppliers. It's like they've gone to IKEA because they can't really afford anything else. Their tools are blunt. Their skills are probably blunter. 4 years it will take them to build with a limited workforce. For context, Herod's temple that will replace this one in Jesus' day takes 86 years to build. This temple, it's like building one of those little independent chapels, you know, the buildings that look kind of like a garage, in the shadow of Lincoln Cathedral. It's deeply unimpressive. The shadow of Solomon's temple lingers over this whole project and over the hearts of the people. And God here is addressing a danger. That they look at outward things and measure the wrong thing. They look at numbers, they look at size, they look at the outwardly impressive things and not at what's really going on. But let me highlight the opposite danger, which can also be a problem for us. The danger in verse 3 here is clearly the danger of discouragement. You can imagine the old men, they sat there, they remember back to their youth, to going up to Passover at the temple, of just being absolutely blown away by these magnificent old buildings. The feasts, the thronging crowds, the buildings that simply took your breath away. Of course, it was all destroyed because the people were faithless. In the generation that these old men can remember. But they're not dwelling on that. The people were muttering, "The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord," as though the very presence of a building would guarantee their safety, and God sent them into exile because of their immorality. They look back to a golden time that, spiritually speaking, was a barren wasteland. They're measuring the wrong thing. Their rose-tinted glasses are causing sight problems for the whole people. Their laments that this temple is so small and pathetic is discouraging all of the builders. Their hands are growing weak. What is even the point of putting the next brick in the wall? It is so pointless. The people are looking back at the wrong thing, at the buildings and not at the hearts of the people who are using the buildings. And so they're discouraged. And maybe that is our danger. Maybe in the particular ministry you're involved with in the church, things seem so weak. Small numbers, little progress, you plough on, but you do feel like giving up sometimes. Perhaps we look back to an England that was full of churches, of prayers in Parliament before big decisions were made, of churches running schools and teaching the gospel to children. If that's us, then we're likely to feel discouraged today. The steady decline of church attendance in England looks unstoppable. What is the point of even trying? But there's an equal and opposite danger for us, which is the danger of being encouraged by the wrong things. See, perhaps we don't look back, perhaps we look around us instead. Our benefice here in Kirkcaldy and Willoughby seems relatively full on Sundays. Even the 8 o'clock service here for Holy Communion has sometimes 20-ish people at it, which is bigger than a lot of Church of England churches get at their main service. Perhaps we think of ourselves as relatively large for our diocese. We're one of the bigger churches. And perhaps we think in terms of those big numbers and we're encouraged. We think we're doing great. And again, the danger is we look at the wrong thing. Solomon's temple was big, but it was destroyed because of the faithlessness of the people. And the size of our churches has little to do with measuring faithfulness. For every Charles Spurgeon preaching to 5,000 people a week, there is a Joel Osteen preaching to 40,000 in what it amounts to a football stadium. At the size of your church, the number of its activities, it actually means nothing in measuring the faith of the church. Activity is not a substitute for faithfulness. And so the people here have made this comparison. They've looked back and they've been discouraged by how much used to happen and how big everything was. And so God says, let me make a similar comparison for you to encourage you. He says, in the future, this temple will be glorious. That's verses 6 to 9. So they look back to the Solomonic temple, and so does God. But from his perspective, things look very different. Verse 9. The glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty. Notice it's a future focus here. It will be. They've got this imagination, but it's a failure of imagination. They can't see what God can see. So they need him to open their eyes. Why will this temple have greater glory than that of Solomon's temple? Verse 8. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, declares the Lord Almighty. Which silver, which gold? All of it. So notice verse 7, which is still concerned with the glory of the temple. Verse 7, I will shake all nations, and what is desired by all nations will come, and I will fill this house with glory, says the Lord Almighty. Now, by itself, this verse is ambiguous. But put together with verse 8, which is clear, it seems to me that what God is saying is that there is a future day when everything good that anyone in any nation desires, the silver and the gold, for example, all the desirable things, all of it will be poured into the temple of God. Now, of course, the question will be asked, how can this be? How can this pathetic little wooden box on small foundations in Jerusalem even hold all of the gold and the silver? But to answer that question, we need to ask a slightly different question, a more important question, which is when? And for that, we need to go back to verse 6 and notice the language of shaking. Verse 7, we see that God will shake the nations like a snow globe on a child's bedside table. God will pick up the world and shake it. And all of the good things will fall down in the temple of God. But when, verse 6, this is what the Lord Almighty says, in a little while I will once more shake the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. This is the end of time. It's the final shaking of the universe. That word shake could just mean earthquake. It could just be a big, catastrophically large global earthquake. But it's very hard to see how an earthquake could be said to shake the whole universe. And it's quite clear that the heavens as well as the earth will shake. Earthquakes are, if you don't know, the consequence of tectonic plates rubbing against each other, which is fine globally, but doesn't work in the heavens. It is not simply a big global catastrophe. The verb here for shake is used throughout the prophets to foretell the great war at the end of time between God and his enemies, the holy war. So the nations bringing in all their precious things to the temple is not so much willing tribute as it is the utterly defeated nations bringing in the victory spoils to God. That is how the Solomonic temple lost all its gold and silver to the Babylonians. And it will be reversed in the most spectacular style. This passage looks forward then, not to a great victory for Israel per se, but to the unshakable city that God is preparing. That is what this passage is about. It's not this temple on this site, but the new Jerusalem that this passage looks forward to. The holy city where Jesus dwells, which is also the most holy place of God. It is the centre of the temple where God dwells with his people. Now, of course, we need to be careful here. Of course, the main thing that the new creation has going for it is that the people of God will be there with their God. That is the big deal all through the scriptures. There's no doubt that the focus through most of the Bible is the people being with God. Just read Revelation 21, 1 to 5. And I think that's often how verse 7 is taken, that it's about the converted people from all the nations coming in. And I'm not wanting to deny that that is going to happen. We are mostly not Israelites who are going to be in that new creation. So I'm not denying that that's a thing at all, but I don't think that's how this would have been taken by the first hearers, the faithful first hearers. They're looking at the physical space and being discouraged, and God is deliberately using the language of gold and silver to make a point, which is to say, the future temple will be glorious. So we must conclude, I think, that not only will all the faithful of all the nations gather in the most holy place of God forever, but that everything that is in any way precious will also be brought in to make the place utterly beautiful, so that it might redound to God's glory. The gold and the silver will be there. It will be the most perfect temple imaginable, for God will build it, and it is eternally unshakable in the heavens. Which actually, at first glance, doesn't really resolve the problem in this passage, does it? After all, what's the point of building this crappy little temple in Jerusalem if God is going to build a much more magnificent temple in the future anyway? If there's going to be a whole new one, what's the point of this one? And yet God thinks there is a link. For in verses 4 and 5 he tells them, be strong, and get to work. Get on with it. Moreover, he says, do it because I am with you. The same thing he said last week. And he says to them, my spirit remains among you. Verse 5. So even though the temple is future, build this one. I am with you in this project. They're to be encouraged. God is building this temple, even whilst he's also preparing to bring in the next temple. And I think this is where the awe and the wonder in this passage really comes out. I want you to notice what God promises in verse 9. The glory of this present house will be greater than the former house. This house, he says. How does that work? I mean, clearly not in geographical or spatial or physical material terms. Because the new temple won't be this one, and that this one will be destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed again. It's not going to be the physical space that he's talking about. Verse 3 tells us, though, that this temple and Solomon's temple are, in some sense, continuous. Did you notice that as we read verse 3? Have a look at verse 3 with me. Who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? And clearly, it's not the same house. It might occupy the same space, but it's not the same house, because the former house, Solomon's temple, was utterly destroyed. But yet in God's thinking, in God's economy, somehow there is a continuity between the two temples. Solomon's to this one to Herod's, and from there on to the final temple. The glory of this house, the future house, will be greater than it was previously. It's not a physical thing. different materials. It's not a geographical thing, especially. It actually isn't anything you can see, I don't think. Jesus makes the connection for us, I think, in Mark 13. At the beginning of his apocalypse, when he goes on to talk about the end of the world, at the very beginning, you remember the story, the disciples say to Jesus, look at these magnificent buildings, Jesus. They haven't even finished building it at this point. But it is a lot more spectacular than this temple. It looks much more grand, much more like Solomon's temple, but they're wrong, you see. Jesus has just judged the temple, said it's unfruitful. The people are not using it as a house of prayer for all the nations, but making it a den of robbers. And Jesus says, it's done. You haven't even finished building it yet, and it's over. For just like Solomon's temple, the building is impressive, but there's no spiritual life in the building. And so it's fallen under judgment. There was a time, of course, when Solomon's temple was full of the Lord's presence and full of prayer. We've just read about in 2 Chronicles, this wonderful picture of God coming to dwell with his people. But centuries later, it's a barren and empty place. God has left it. And he kicks the people from the land. So it will be with Herod's temple. And Jesus says, I'm the temple, actually. And I'm the cornerstone around which God is building a new temple of living stones, of people who will trust in me and will be built up into the glorious temple in the new creation. The people of God starts now, he says. The new temple begins now. And prayer can happen not only at the temple, but wherever there's a Christian. So I want you to see something very important here. Although Haggai is looking to the physical place and Jesus focuses on the spiritual reality of the people, both of them are actually talking about the same thing. When God says to Haggai that this temple will be beautiful, he doesn't mean the physical space, although he tells the people to build the physical space. If the focus is on the physical space, it is discouraging whether God is with you or not. It looks unimpressive. It's like Sisyphus pushing that rock up the hill and up the hill and up the hill when God is just going to pick it up and put it at the top anyway. What's the point? Solomon's temple, built by faith, was the temple until there were no faithful people left in it. And then God judged it, destroyed it. And so it will be with Herod's temple. And so it would be actually with this one too. On the other hand, this pathetic looking temple in 520 BC is the fruit of faith. It is the people of God getting on with the work that God has given them to do in faithfulness. The repentant people of God have got to work to offer God what they can do. It doesn't seem much. It seems dramatically unimpressive. But unlike with Solomon's temple 70 years before that was destroyed, God is in the midst of them in this place. They are to build this temple, not because it is grand, and not to bring God to live in the midst of his people, but because they are his people, and he's already dwelling in the midst of them, and because this is the project that God has given them to build. And faith gets on with whatever it is God is doing, however pathetic it looks. And these people who, by faith, built an unimpressive temple were actually building faithfulness in themselves. By getting on with what God called them to do, they were beautifying the true temple by growing in faith as they kept on going, doing what God had called them to do. Do you see, the temple God is building is the people who will dwell in that beautiful kingdom that he will provide. He gave them this project because it has the effect of making them more fit for the kingdom that is to come. They shouldn't be discouraged by numbers or by buildings, not by looking back to former days of glory or by looking forward to future days so far beyond their comprehension they cannot begin to even conceive of it. No, they are to be a people who, living by faith, are becoming the very thing that God has always been building. God has always been far more concerned with faithfulness than by buildings. And so to us, don't be deceived by physical appearances. Don't be overly encouraged by numbers on a Sunday. Don't be discouraged by relative numbers compared to times past. We don't know about the faithfulness of previous generations. That's for God to know. Whether we feel encouraged or discouraged by our numbers or the numbers in our Sunday school or youth work or in our workplace Bible study or whatever it is, if we're looking at numbers, we're looking at the wrong thing. We must be those who look forward in hope to what God is preparing, excited to be a part of his people, going on to his unshakable temple forever. It will be brilliant. And that should motivate us not to build another physical temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, for that was never really the thing in the first place. God is already dwelling in the midst of his people. By his Spirit, he is with us this evening. And so we need to be a fit temple for his dwelling. By faith, of course, we are purified by Jesus. We're right with God, and so we've become the perfect dwelling place for God's Holy Spirit, though we are still sinners. But we look forward to a day when sin is gone, when every vestige of unfaithfulness amongst us is a distant memory. And so, he says, be strong. Don't be discouraged by how feeble our faithfulness looks. Build the church. We're only in the first 5 minutes of the bake-off. You still can't see what it is that he's building with us. The kitchen's a bit of a mess. The oven's only just gone on. But if we build in faith, God is with us. As we love each other, as we encourage each other, as we rebuke and correct each other, as we train one another, as hurts are healed, as needs are met, as we, in those lovely words, apply the sword that makes the wounded whole, so we will have the joy of playing our own part in the grand work that God is building, unseen by human eyes now, but one day, glorious. I am with you, declares the Lord Almighty. My Spirit remains among you. Do not fear. Whatever your ministry might look like this week, this month, there can surely be no greater encouragement to persevere than to know that God is in the midst of us. Do not fear. Let's pray. Our Father, you are